Gentlemen, is one of the latest collaborative efforts of Joni Pilato and Bradley Parker Sparrow. It's a CD. Remember those? A CD called Float Out to Sea. It's always great to see you, too. It's really great to see you late at night because that's what I'm basically used to with.
I know. Here we are.
And it's here good. You are. Before we get into this remarkable event coming up on April 28th, a toast to George Freeman, which takes place at City Winery, and you people will get all the information you need to get tickets to this. I want to talk to you two about your lives and careers and fighting to keep jazz alive. Joni, I first saw you at some bygone, it had to be a bygone club because there just aren't those that many left, aren't there?
It was the Raccoon Club.
That was a great place.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would sing there with Willie Pickens' trio. Our dear Willie Pickens, and I would do costume changes in between sets because they actually had a dressing room.
Right.
For a jazz club, I guess a green room, yeah.
And you were, by that time, you guys had been married for a while at that time, right?
Well, we were married in 82.
Yeah, this would have been, my guess would have been about... 86, Whisper Not, your CD.
Yes.
Was just out. And as I got to meet your husband collaborator, and, you know, over the years, Sparrow, first I learned you're from the South Side. Then I learned you were a self-taught musician. Then I learned you studied journalism and photography at DePaul. Then I learned that the only thing we shared in our creative career is driving a taxi cab. How did you first come to music? I think your mic's not working, and here comes Aubrey Mumpower on a mission of mercy. This is the world's greatest engineer.
Aw.
Well, he's going to fix it. No, we didn't do anything. Look, this is great. They have their own sound studio. Look at him.
I've got a mic in my purse if you need it. No, we're good. Well, speaking of Sparrow and all these things through the years that he's done that, sure. I learned about as we...
Wait, how did you two meet? That's something I'm sure I know, but I do not, if I do, I don't remember it.
We were both at a club called Redford's on Lincoln Avenue.
Sure.
Remember?
Sure.
All the old clubs, all the bygone eras. And we were both playing a No Nukes benefit.
Oh, neat.
And Sparrow was his usual self, doing more than one thing at once. He was playing with his band and doing sound. So I was singing standards with a guitar player, and he gave me his card on the break and said he was looking for a singer for his band,
mm-hmm.
and the rest is history.
Then when did you start? When did you start the record label, and why, Sparrow? I mean, I know, you know, at the time, you know, mid-80s or so, that it seemed like a viable, great idea, I suppose, at the time.
You know, it was a really strange time. I kind of started the label in 77.
Wow.
And I got it together to tape a record 4-track in a coach house where I was living.
Yeah.
And I mixed it up at an old studio called Acme with Mike Rasfeld on Southport.
Sure, remember that too.
And I tried to shop the record, but nobody wanted to put it out.
Is that right?
Even Bob Kester didn't want it.
Wow.
At Del Mar.
Yeah,
at
Del Mar.
But he did me a favor. Now we've got 147 projects.
I know. I wrote about you guys in 2013 when you were at 137. And I found it even then a remarkable thing because you have been able to, you have been terribly Chicago-centric with your label. You have, you know, from Max Zabril Tyler, the kid on
Max,
inside.
Now Max ZT.
Yeah. Oh, is it
Max? He's a star now.
Well, oh, yeah. I mean, but everybody who's been on your label, I mean, you could run through these. You know, you recorded Paulino Garcia, Bob Acri, who was a legend. Well, all these people are legends. Did you go out and try to find them, or were they drawn to you? And once they knew you had started Southport Records, did they come to you, or did you go out and actively solicit I think some of the performers you knew and loved?
Well, it was a combination of things, Rick, because I think in the beginning, after Sparrow did his first recordings and then mine, and then we were like, well, Willie Pickens was such a great, great artist. He recorded on my first CD, Whisper Not, and we thought, we need a flagship artist. Yeah. We need somebody that is going to put Southport on the map. So we said, Willie, would you do a record with us? And of course, that was his first recording as a leader. He didn't have any other records out under his own name. When he did It's About Time. Yeah.
Then as a result, you gave what I think of as voice to people who never, and I'm including George Freeman, who you're celebrating too, who never had really had the opportunity. They loved to play so much that they, none of us in this room are business people, but they never thought of themselves as, oh, I need a CD or I need this. I mean, they were players.
But see, to be real honest with you, I feel that they gave us a voice.
I know that.
You know?
Oh, I know that. I know that. I know you feel that way, but it's this mutual kind of artistry going on there and mutual creativity.
You know, I was always amazed when we did Von Freeman's first CD, Walkin' Tough, and we had become friends and we had done some gigs together, that he wasn't being actively recorded at his age.
Yeah.
Because he had a record out on, I think it was Atlantic, that Roland Kirk produced as a favor for Vaughn, because he was much more famous than Vaughn. And Vaughn didn't like touring. He would go to the gig, go back home, or be with the family.
Yeah.
But I was surprised when we said, hey, you want to do a record? He said, sure.
There's some kind of inherent thing in jazz, I think. You know, you do have Louis Armstrong, who was not at all self-effacing, for instance, and was a giant. But some of the people we've known, you way more, many more than I, in this environment, were doing the music out of love without any real consideration for their fame. Is that too naive?
No, and in fact, I always think that some of the greatest art we never see, because some people, either they don't care or they're shy or they have bad luck to project their art form. And art has dwindled so much now because everyone is so much into the marketing before the art exists.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's why there's so many bad movies and bad records.
And bad books.
Yeah.
I'm talking this entire hour with Joni Pilato, astonishingly talented singer, and her husband, Bradley Parker Sparrow, who is everything else. I've actually never heard you sing. I'm not going to make you sing, but
could be scary.
He plays a million, same here, plays a million different instruments, and they have for more than 30 years run Southport Records. They've been married for almost 35. Sparrow Sound Design. I have been in that room recording. Was honored to record something for him. And they are part of this Toast to George Freeman, which comes up on April 28th. We're going to spend the rest of this half hour talking about their career. I'm going to tell you a couple things that they told me and have them expand on those. It's all about the making of music and the meaning of making of music. So we'll be back after a short commercial break, during which I will tell you that Chicago's Best is going on a pizza journey. Detroit, New York, Chicago style, and more, all on the new Chicago's Best, Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. Again, the stunning collaborative effort of Joni Pilato and her husband, Bradley Parker Sparrow. Sparrow, some time ago, you told me something that is, I think, every true artist would take to heart, whether they're in the visual arts or the written word or making music. You said about your career and your record label, my theory, Rick, is instead of selling a million records, I will make a million individual records that are true to my visions. You still believe that?
Amen.
expand on that a little bit. You've never been in, well, Joni came up the same conversation to embellish that, said, Rick, when you're a jazz artist putting out jazz records, you're not going to be a big star anyway.
No pressure.
So you just do what you love. That's when truth shines. Expand upon that for me, both of you.
I think beauty is always the journey and the creation. Playing the piano, for example, is so nice, especially acoustic piano, because it's just there. You can milk it. It's almost like a visual book. Improvisation is good because it's almost a zen-like way to release and to be creative. It gets a little dicey when you try to sell something you've created, and I wish maybe some of the big marketing people would give artists more of a hand. But the real beauty is the creation and the peace of mind, and I think it makes you healthier too.
Yeah, that's a very empowering kind of thing.
And as a singer, it's the best because you have a portable instrument, you know, and it can be in your mind. I can just think a melody in my head and not have to even think about music and get away from all of what's on the written page and just create that way.
I've also got to think for the two of you that one of the great joys is that magical kind of interaction that can take place in live performance. I mean, I think this entire world in all sorts of ways is moving away from all manner of live performances, of sharing your space with an audience that is sharing a space and music with one another. That, I think, is what would keep me going as an artist.
Yeah, the live thing is very unique. It's very special. And last night, we were at the Green Mill, and they were celebrating George Freeman's 91st birthday.
Which was a few days ago, April 10th,
yeah, April 10th,
I think.
Yeah. But George, it's like he has this whole new lease on his life and his creativity. He sounds better than I think he ever sounded in his life. Our jaws were dropping at the sounds he was making last night. There were lines out the door. It was raining. It was horrible out last night.
Yeah.
And that band was jamming. George sounded great. We're so thrilled for him.
You are part of this huge event. You're helping put it on. Southport Records and Lampkin Music Group are presenting a toast to George Freeman. Special guests are the two of you, as well as the one and only and inimitable Billy Branch.
Billy.
Yeah, Billy. What a character. What a wonderful character. How is that possible, do you think, that... I suppose there are some people that would argue that Sinatra was a better singer when he was, 65 than he was at 25. Mm. But is it different for non-singers?
You mean like...
To grow...
For an instrumentalist?
Yes. Is the voice as an instrument,
instrument. Because what George is doing is every note that he plays has meaning and importance. And he may not be, doing those fast licks, like when you're a teenager in your youth. But every note has importance, and you can just tell when you hear the tone that he's producing, it's just got heart.
Sparrow, is that true of your piano playing also? Do you feel that?
You know, I feel, as I get older, I feel more relaxed, less aggressive in certain ways.
Yeah.
Maybe less dissonant.
Mm-hmm.
And more at peace.
With yourself.
Right. You do get a little tendonitis in the fingers. but it goes away once you start, getting a good groove going.
When you recorded George, I think a couple of years ago, with his nephew, Chico,
Chico Freeman.
Talk to me, and then in the second half hour, I promise we'll play some George Freeman for you, but I want to get at this family. I mean, these two guys, two of the giants of not just local jazz, Von Freeman and his brother George and nephew, son, Chico. How does this come to be? What's their background?
Well, I think the essence with them and a lot of musicians is their parents were really into music. And his father, Vaughn and George's father, was a policeman. And in the evening, he would let Louis Armstrong stop by the house. They had a piano.
Wow.
Count Basie. And his father really loved music. So when they were both small, they would see these great people.
They were exposed to these
they
giants.
They were exposed in the house.
In the house.
In the most
intimate club you could find.
Yeah, and their mother was also a wonderful singer. And she really brought the music to them. And George told me that the piano that's still in his house, he said when he was a little kid, he said he'd see this big piano in the living room, and he was a little scared of it because it was this big instrument, and he said he'd crawl out there when he was a little kid. And I said, you have that memory?
Yeah.
Yes, from a child.
You know, it's interesting you bring this up that you know, they saw Count Basie and Louis Armstrong in their house, and proverbially, and over the years, it's like, well, my God, Count Basie's dead, so jazz is dead. You know what has happened, I think, is there is no... On a large segment of the population, there is no, you guys understand it, I understand it a little, that this is a continuum. This jazz isn't dying, or there may not be as many places to listen to it as there once were, but this music is not dying. Von Freeman did die, mm-hmm. George will, we all will, but you must have an unbelievable amount of hope in what is coming, or do you? What's coming? I don't need to name specific people, but the music can't...
I think that's the creativity, that you have to keep that line open to create new music and new material. It's one thing to go back and revisit the great songwriters and standards.
Sure.
But, you know, Sparrow being the composer of the family, if you will, you know, I've been very inspired to always try to think of new songs and to create something new. And George Freeman said the same thing just the other day. He said, you never know when it's going to hit you, that inspiration to write something new.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
What inspires you, Sparrow, when to come up, both of you, to come up with a song? Is it something you see? Is it something you hear? Is it a grand mystery?
You know, it could be a million different things. The one song, Float Out to Sea.
Yeah.
I actually had the lyric before the melody. I wasn't by a piano when I wrote it.
Yeah.
And when I put it all together, I just thought it would be nice. You know, you always get tired of all your possessions and all the problems. Just kind of just getting on a boat and just not coming back.
I love that idea.
And no one knows what happened to you. You just float out to sea. And maybe it was from Gilligan's Island.
the great jazz influence, Gilligan's Island, episode 18. It is so lovely to see the two of you, Bradley Parker Sparrow and Joni Pilato. They're going to be part of a toast to George Freeman at the City Winery Saturday, April 28th. Perfect timing. Noon to 3. Just go to citywinery.com/Chicago. And better yet, go to chicagosound.com, the website, and see the, how many now? 300 and how many?
Oh, on the label?
Yeah.
Float Out to Sea, our last record was 147.
147.
I hit them up at 137, and they're still at it. Stay tuned. We'll play some more of their music, and you will hear what George Freeman sounds like after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WG in Chicago. That again, the duo, Bradley Parker Sparrow and his wife, Joni Pilato. Go to, as I said before, go to chicagosound.com and you can pick up their CDs and the music of, and I know you people listen to CDs, and the music of so many others. You did an album Does anybody in the world except me call these albums?
No, we still call them albums.
Do you?
Sure.
Oh my God, thank
yeah.
God.
Mm-hmm.
Did an album with George Freeman and his nephew Chico.
Mm-hmm.
There was another Freeman brother in addition to Vaughn I did not know about. Who was that?
The eldest was Bruzz Freeman, and he was a wonderful drummer. And we actually had the opportunity to hang out with him one summer several years ago. He was in town. He was living in Hawaii. He was teaching tennis. I know. And Vaughn was playing at the Jazz Fest.
Yeah.
And our good friend Judy Mayo, we were hanging out there together, and we asked Vaughn's permission if we could take Bruzz out. And we had the best time. We took him to Pops for champagne when they were on Sheffield, and we sat at the Garden, and then we took him back to the studio, and he wanted to go to the showcase, and he got to sit in at the Jazz Showcase, and we had the best time with Bruzz, and we never got to record him, sadly. I wish we had.
It must be inspiring for the two of you on a weekly, if not daily basis, to be surrounded by all of these like-minded grand talents. It's got to be, not to make too much of it, it's got to be inspiring, Sparrow, isn't it?
Well, it's motivating, and what's really motivating is it's as if art was a different type of organ in their body. It just was just radiating just out of the love of the art. No angle. And it kind of, you hope it rubs off on you, inspires you. Especially when someone reaches the age of 90 or 92.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned Bob Acri.
Sure, sure.
And he hadn't done that much recording, and his son, who's a drummer, was helping put his record together. And he had more fun when we did the photo shoot.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was such a gentleman and a good composer, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of guys out there now who are still playing in their... He always seemed incredibly youthful to me, but Bobby Lewis is still out there.
Oh, the king.
Like crazy. How old is Bobby now?
Oh, he's young at heart.
Oh, he always was. Chronologically, he may be up there, but he is one of the youngest people I know. So we have on April 28th from noon to 3, a toast to George Freeman. How did this come about? It's at City Winery. How did it come about, and how did you two get involved?
Let's celebrate George now.
Yeah.
We wanted to, and Sparrow always comes up with these great titles, and he said, we got to do a toast to George Freeman. And I said, that sounds like a great start for the show, you know. And then we talked to our co-producer, Ralph Lampkin, and he got us booked at the City Winery, and we're off to the races. It's going to be a great show. They're going to have a brunch. And Billy Branch pairing George with Billy, they've played together before. It's been
sure.
a while,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I said, we're going to have a rehearsal and whatever. And they've talked to each other on the phone, and I think they're just going to play.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be like note. Let's play these notes. Let's do this chart. Let's do this arrangement. They're just going to play.
Now, do you two know what you're going to play? I mean, will you be part of any kind of rehearsal process for this?
Or
are you
we're basically going to be the opening act with our band, with John Devlin on bass and Louise Everling on drums. And we'll be the opening act. So we'll play our own music. We'll play a short set. Open it up for George.
Sparrow, is this going to be emotional for you on any level? I know you've played, with a lot of people who you greatly, greatly admire. But this whole, 91st year and a birthday celebration, does that carry any kind of emotional punch for you?
Yeah, I think hopefully it'll be motivating.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to be around when I'm 94.
Okay.
Or maybe 104.
Well, and as George said last night, he said, I'll see you here next year for my 92nd.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's something.
And it's surprising when someone tells you, I feel like my life is starting over again. And when you shake his hand, his grip, it'd break your fingers.
Why do you, God, this is maybe a complicated, mm-hmm. impossible answer to the question, but why is that, do you think? I mean, because there is such... joy. A lot of people wind down,
mm-hmm.
and they think, okay, my time has passed. I've got to think he can look out at a crowd at the Green Mill or what he will see at City Winery, and he sees all these young faces, these young white, black, yellow mm-hmm. faces. That's got to be one of the motivating forces for him, yeah?
I think the fact that he's getting out of the house, that he's composing, rejuvenates him. And I think art could be almost like a stimulant.
Yeah.
And
or a fountain of youth.
And after being ignored, I mean, here's a guy that played with Charlie Parker.
Yeah, he played. That's another thing. Talk about that. I mean, George Freeman played with every giant
yes.
of the last 60 years.
Every giant, including Charlie Parker, Gene Ammons, the list goes on. And he's got the stories to talk about it, too,
yeah.
and the recordings from many recordings in the day, and what a legacy. Wow.
Does he, when he's playing, I haven't seen him play in ages, when he's playing, does he talk between numbers often, anecdotal stories, or not so much?
Not so much on stage. I mean, he'll talk.
Well, with you guys, yeah.
Well,
yeah. sure. What was it like to be in that studio while he and Chico recorded their CD for you guys?
It was very special because they had never done a recording together.
Never.
In all the years. They'd played live together on you know,
I'm
different
sure.
clubs and stuff and different joints, you know, on the South Side.
Yeah, well, sure.
But they'd never recorded together. Now, Chico recorded a lot with his father, with Vaughn, and they toured all over the world together. But George and Chico had never recorded.
Let me
we
ask
should
the
play
two
something.
Of you. Yeah. Say, Aubrey, when you get a chance, there's a CD in there called All in the Family.
Another great Sparrow title.
That is a good title. Do you see that? Okay, we are going to, in about 2 seconds, or whenever you're ready, play Cut 12, which is called Marco.
Which George composed and named it for his other nephew, Mark Freeman, Vaughn's
Cut
other
21?
Son. No, 12.
12.
Yeah.
She says 12. You say 21?
Oh, is it? I'm sorry. Maybe it is.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're probably right.
21.
Yeah.
Marco.
21.
Cut 21. Okay, set it up, Joni. Say it again.
Yeah, this is Marco, and it's for Mark Freeman, George's nephew, Chico's brother.
Does he play too, Marco?
He does, but not professionally these days.
Well, here it is. Here, ladies and gentlemen, finally.
He's a great
George
musician,
George Freeman
too.
From the Southport CD... All in the Family.
Oh, Rocco.
Well, not a lot of lyrics in that tune, but that's a great, great, great tune. That was George Freeman and his nephew Chico Freeman and some others from the 2015 CD All in the Family. That was the first recorded pairing of George Freeman and his nephew. What was that like for them? Did they look at each other, hey, man, we've never done that. I know they'd played together, but having that kind of permanence must have been very special for them.
Well, I think they found a new musical bond.
Yeah, I'll bet. Mm-hmm. I'll bet.
And with a lot of cats, they hardly ever record, and most of the music is kind of offered to the air and it just floats around.
Yeah.
And thank God we've got the recordings that we have.
No kidding. That's why what you've done with Southport Records, and you can...
And if I may quickly mention...
You can do anything you want.
Thank you, darling. That was Harrison Bankhead on that bass solo.
Oh, okay.
He was singing along with
that.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody
it was a great
should get
solo.
Credit.
Kirk Brown's on piano, and Joe Jenkins, a friend of George's for many, many years, is on drums. Papa Joe, and then Hamid Drake is on other tracks.
You were
the great
so,
Hamid Drake.
You were so good to musicians. We've got to take a short little break, then we'll come back and tell people some more about this Sunday, April 28th, noon to 3. You get a little brunch, and you get some incredible music at a toast to George. We'll be right back. This is track 12 from...
there it is.
Joni Pilato brought in about 42 CDs, hoping that it might snow and we'd be stranded in here and no other host could get on and we could go live till 8 o'clock in the morning. But you can access and buy those CDs by going to chicagosound.com. It's a great website that explains... Yet further, what we haven't touched on, who Joni Pilato and her husband Bradley Parker Sparrow are, and they have captured the sounds of the city over the last 30 years and kept them. You know, many of the sounds of the city have flown out the window at the Green Mill and flown out the window at the Showcase and flown out the window at Andy's, and all you have is memories, and you can evoke those memories by going into chicagosound.com and just ordering whatever you want. You can make memories on Sunday, April 28th from noon to 3 by going to City Winery. That would be citywinery.com/Chicago to participate in, and you don't have to play anything. You just have to sit there. A toast to George Freeman, a show that will feature George Freeman, Billy Branch, these two incredible people. There's a lot of people are involved in putting a thing like this together, Joni, aren't there?
Yeah. In fact, our co-producer, Ralph Lampkin, is presenting with us, and our media sponsors, the WFMT Radio Network's
That's
Jazz
great.
Network.
That's
yeah,
great.
Tony Macaluso really helped us with that, and Neil Tesser is going to be our MC.
Oh, my God. You got to give Neil my best. When I was a TV critic for this crazy paper, and Neil was at home freelancing and doing whatever he did, running for Playboy and doing all sorts of other reviews. He and I would trust each other. We played Jeopardy against each other on the telephone. I would watch it on my, I was a TV critic then, so I could watch TV. And we had a wonderful year of playing Jeopardy against one another on TV. So give him a big hug for me.
Absolutely.
He's been a great booster of jazz for
forever.
40 years.
Yeah.
For 40 years. Are you, in the couple minutes we have left, I want you to say yes, but you don't have to. You two must be very, very hopeful, not only for the future of Southport, but for the future of jazz in this town.
Profoundly hopeful, and I think, basically, it can only get better. Also, we must remember one other thing, too. The jazz is kind of like a spider. It has a part of every form of music, including new classical music, even one-dimensional rap and hip-hop because of the use of poetry. And a lot of the songs now, the kids are much more educated. They can play anything.
Yeah.
And they can see through music that's not good music.
Wow. That's a hopeful note. And as for Southport, you're going to find those people who can make that kind of music, aren't you? You're going to keep looking.
They're there. They're out there.
What about you?
I'm really, really wanting to work on a new record of all of my original music. Because I did two.
Yeah.
And it's been a while, and I feel like it's time again. I'm feeling that pull, and that's my next project.
This is great.
I'm inspired by Sparrow as a composer, and he's always encouraged me to write music and write my own songs. And when you can write your own songs, music, and lyrics, then you can really show what's inside your soul.
You once said, Joni Pallotta, and we'll end with this because it's very inspiring and it's nice to use, Sparrow. You said about your work that the seed of the song has always come from the heart and mind of Sparrow. He plants that seed and I can make it grow. Mm. That's a lovely, lovely thought for a rainy, rainy Sunday night. Once again, go to chicagosound.com. You will learn everything you need to know, except some of our mutual secrets about Bradley Parker, Sparrow, and Joni Pallotta. They will be at A Toast to George at City Winery April 28th from noon to 3. You can find that information, too, on Chicago Sound. They have cataloged the sounds of this city for the last 30 years, and you should partake of that. It's great to see you guys always.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Anytime. Now, if you can carry all those CDs home, you'll get home. Safe travels, you guys. Safe travels. We'll be back after a couple commercials and the news. This hour, you will hear from Alan Barkus, who is the world's greatest over 80 basketball player. That's so funny. I just decided to pick Alan's music, not realizing that Chuck Freilich, my guest for this next hour, and I were two of the great teenage basketball players I've ever known.
We were stars.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, Alan Barkus is a fascinating guy. He's a musician who lives in LaPorte, Indiana. And I met him. He sent me a couple songs. He was the first musical director at the Playboy Club, which sounds like the greatest job in the world. And then he sent me a magazine with his picture on the cover. He was named the greatest over 70 basketball player in the world. He's in a league that plays internationally, and he is still playing. He's got to be.
Aren't you still playing?
Not much. Not much, Chuck. Chuck and I went to high school at the Latin school, and we did play basketball together, and I've always admired Chuck. His father was one of my doctors. You went to Yale after Latin.
That's right.
With the intention of doing what?
Oh, I don't think I had any clear intentions what I was going to do, but I studied philosophy there. And when I was there, I was really interested in film, and I think I was thinking about a film career for a while.
Yeah.
And my roommate was in the film society, so we used to go to films all the time in the evening. And I tried to get into the film society, and the head of the film society was Michael Medved.
Oh,
you remember him?
Oh, yeah, sure. And he wouldn't let you in?
He didn't like me, so.
good. What did you wind up doing after school? I know we've caught up a bit over the years, and we run into each other. I know you eventually wound up at Columbia College, but what happened in between that, Chuck?
Right. Well, after college, I went to Stony Brook, State University of New York, and studied philosophy there. And
in doing that, in furthering your education with a quest toward philosophy, what's your notion of what you're going to do with that?
Well, that was always the problem. Yeah, right. And, you know, I mean, I thought
like your father now. Yeah.
No, I mean, I thought I would come out and teach philosophy, of course, you know, get a job at a university. And we were all in a PhD program at the time, and I only spent 1 year there because, I mean, the job prospects were not so great at the time in the academic world. And it's funny because I just got back in touch with one of the guys who was in my cadre, you know, of PhD students, and he had a really interesting career, and he ended up becoming the pardon attorney for the Department of Justice.
So
I just gave him a call. I hadn't spoken to him in 45 years, and I thought it was so interesting what happened to him. So I gave him a call, and we talked about old times at Stony Brook. And so I asked him the question. I said, if Trump wants to pardon himself, does he have to go through your office?
And does he?
He said, no.
Too bad.
He said, that's different. That's a political pardon. You
too
know,
bad. But, what if
but all requests for
is
pardons
it national
go through.
Pardon? Well, what about if he wants to pardon, if Trump wants to pardon Rod Blagojevich?
Well, he can go do whatever he wants, but all requests for pardons have to go through this guy's office.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
So it's funny what happens to people.
And now that you and I are older, and that's part of what we're going to talk about, because you work for this incredibly admirable prize-winning Mather Lifeways, which is in technical terms, a non-denominational, not-for-profit organization based in Evanston that helps people. Helps people get
age old. Age well, right?
Yeah.
We create ways to age well. And, my part of that is really just mainly lifelong learning. So that's what I did at Columbia. I did it at DePaul, at Scheimer College. So, a little bit.
What does that mean, though? What does
lifelong
mean?
Learning?
I know it seems to be its own definition, but what does it mean?
Yeah, it just means continuing to learn, to be interested in ideas, to be interested in society, to be interested in music. I really enjoyed listening to Joni and Spiro.
They're interesting people, aren't they?
They were great.
And they're also very, very talented. This is something I have to assume that is, and you may know the big picture in late life care, that it seemed to me that for generations, people retired. They either decided to sit on a couch and watch TV. Maybe they decided to golf. I will never forget that a mutual friend of ours, David Pressman, started enrolling in classes at Northwestern. And every time I would see him, he'd tell me about this new thing he was learning. He's taking a language and he's studying European history or something.
That's right. That's...
Is this a relatively recent phenomenon, or did I just know too many people who devoted their lives to golf?
Well, it could be. I mean, I think, the whole concept of retirement is changing, and we're part of that. There are many organizations involved in kind of redefining what retirement is. We call it repriorment ourselves.
I know.
And
that's not even a word.
No, it's just a made-up word, but what we're talking about is reprioritizing.
Yeah.
So when you get older, if you're not committed to taking care of a family or working at a job, you have time to pursue whatever it is you're really interested in. Maybe something that you didn't have time to do before.
Something that you gave up.
Something that you gave up. Yeah, exactly. A lot of people give up music, playing an instrument or singing.
You were a musician. Have you?
Right. No, I haven't. I've continued to do that. So
yeah.
I'm still an amateur piano player. And over the years, I've, really gotten more involved in doing things with the piano. I'm still an amateur, but it all started really when Thomas Zells at Pianoforte Chicago started.
Sure.
You know him.
Yeah.
He started an amateur piano competition, and I entered it, just on a lark.
Yeah.
And it led from that to all sorts of contacts with other piano players around Chicago. We have regular groups now that meet at Pianoforte. I got involved in doing some chamber music. Right now I'm working with a woman who used to teach piano, and we're doing some two piano work together. So
that's fantastic.
So it was like one thing led to another, and that's kind of
what you're at Mather trying
right,
to
that's
do.
What
it's
we're
making
trying
these
to
connections
do.
And making
exactly
because I was thinking to myself that a lot of people, when they retire, are almost at loose ends. Unless
right.
It's like, let's take a cruise, honey, or I'm going to go play golf tomorrow. This is fascinating. Chuck's right. going to be here almost this entire hour, so please stay tuned. We'll talk more about Mather Lifeways and also specifically what he does there, which is booking people into. Do you do their Mather's more than a cafe? Are there three of them?
Right, there are three of them around the city.
And you book you
and I book
program
programs
them.
for all three of the cafes.
That's great. This is going to be fascinating. It's also really nice to see you because I remember
it's good to
what
see
a,
you.
What a good basketball player we both were. We'll take a short break during which I will tell you first of all. Fly to the front of the line at LitFest. Oh, my God, LitFest is coming up on June 9th and 10th with a Fest Pass. Get yours before they're gone at printersrowlitfest.org/FestPass. We'll be right back. That's the music of Alan Barkas, the world's greatest septuagenarian basketball player. I'm with my friend Chuck Freilich, who works at Mather Lifeways, which is a complete care. What do you? I mean, the over. What's a definition? I mean, it.
I'm sure the
definition of that kind of thing changes every year these days.
Right. Well, I mean, we do a number of different things with older adults. So we do operate some residences for senior living. One's in Evanston called the Mather, and there's another one in Wilmette called Mather Place of Wilmette. We have another residence in Tucson, actually, called
wow.
Splendido. So
that's the one I'd like to live in. That's the
right.
one I need a room in.
So we operate the residences. We also do things in the community. So, and one of the things that we do is we operate a number of cafes. There are three cafes in the Chicago area.
And the cafes are also, as I remember, are open to anybody.
Yeah, anybody can come in. Anybody can eat there. The programs are supposed to be for older adults who
right.
come to the cafe. But it's basically a neighborhood place, just a friendly place for older adults where they can get good food, but also we offer programs. You know,
how often are there programs? Because you were in charge of dealing with the programming there,
right? But I'm not the only one who does the programming.
Sure, I don't
it's
see
all,
how you could.
It's a very big team effort, and there are a lot of people doing programming. I mainly do the lifelong learning programming, but we also have fitness programming, so we have other people who do that. We have musical performances, so we have people. The cafe managers do a lot of the programming themselves.
How often on a weekly basis?
Well, there are programs going on all day. So there are fitness classes, there are art classes, there are lifelong learning classes.
Musical
performances in the evening. So, you know, basically the whole day is full of all different kinds of
programs. It seems to me one of the notions is not just to supply that kind of programming for the residents of Mather Lifeways, but also it's a way to tie it and make these places viable parts of the larger community.
Right. Right. I mean, we try to develop programming that'll get people involved in the community doing things. So in other words, the programs aren't passive. They're not just programs that you come to and listen to a lecture or something.
Sure.
But they're supposed to try to get people engaged in doing something. And it doesn't really matter what it is. It can be anything, you know, but to actually do something and not just listen to something. So we try to inspire them to get active in anyway, you know, that's what my title is, you know, so lifelong engagement, you know, and repriorment. But
repriorment, what a weird
yeah, I know.
I get it.
It's just a positive spin. We're just putting a positive spin on retirement. And
how long have you been doing this?
So about 10 years.
How has it changed in the last 10 years?
Well, there was a big change, you know, when the economy changed. And
which was roughly about 10 years ago.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right, yeah. 2008. So, and that was just about the time I had first come to Mather. So there was a little change then because we were talking about the boomers and what the boomers were going to do, you know, what we are going to do. And so, you know, when the economy changed, people's ideas about what they were going to do changed also. And, you know, people realized, well, maybe I'll be working longer. You know, maybe I won't retire. Maybe I'll work part time. Maybe I'll volunteer, you know. So people's planning on retirement changed a lot at that time. But the basics of what I do, you know, lifelong learning doesn't really change.
Yeah, and there's it's a big umbrella too. That is a big
right, and it can
umbrella.
Be anything. So you know,
you must have. I mean, you know, at one point, 10 years ago, you were probably teaching people how to use iPhones.
Right. Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, we still do things like that, and we had a big. That was a big part of our programming was teaching people how to use computers. So we offered computer classes. You know, and we still do that, and we still teach technology, but not so much computers anymore, you know, because people don't use those
right.
as much.
Now
right? People use their phones. So we teach people how
artificial
to do that.
Intelligence or something.
Right.
Yeah.
We teach people about virtual reality. You know, we let them sample that, and that's a lot of fun, you know, so because a lot of people haven't tried this before, and they try it, and they realize how much fun it can be.
I've got to think, and I'm saying this because we are of a certain age, but I've got to think, you know, the whole, you know, 70 now seems like the new 40 to me.
Yeah.
And I think the needs as they have been sort of become kind of cliched, like, oh, the retired person needs this. Maybe you need a little stretching exercises. You know, that is such BS at this point, don't you
right.
think?
Well, I mean,
you know better than I. You're intimately involved.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what we're dealing with, really, kind of the new approach to retirement. And people don't think that way anymore. They don't think of it as just retreating from life, retiring, you know, and not doing anything.
Right.
It's remaining active in some way, remaining engaged, either working, volunteering, working part-time, you know, all of these options that are available.
You must, however, still sometimes encounter the person who does want to just, and it must be a joy for you to see someone drawn into life, but you must still encounter the person who is living a kind of old-fashioned aesthetic where, well, I've turned 65, I've got my pension, now all I want to do is just relax.
Oh, sure. I mean, there are many people like that. But we try to motivate them to change, to transform themselves, you know, in some way. And the way to do that, I mean, partly is just, you know, through one-on-one contact with a person and encouraging them to take that first step, maybe try something new that they, you know, didn't think that they would like, you know, and then following that up with more steps and persevering, and eventually, you know, small changes can take place. So
you've seen that happen. It
oh, yeah.
must be very encouraging.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you.
We have, you know, wonderful stories of people, you know, who have really transformed their lives and have started doing things that they never thought they would do. For example, there was a guy at our cafe at Norwood Park, and he liked to draw and cartoon. And there was another person who wanted to write a children's book. So our cafe manager put them together, and they actually produced their own book, and they got it published, you know, and
wow.
And then they turned out another one after that. So one thing led to, you know, many good things.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah,
because the other thing that went in the toilet in around 2000, it was the publishing business.
Oh.
I mean, it's now turned. I mean, it's as crazy as the recording business we were just
right.
talking about. I want to play a song, Aubrey. Sir, are we out at 27 or all the way?
27.
Okay, I don't want to play a song right now. I'm going to play one after this. But You found this. You found this. We got 2 minutes before we got to take a break. You found this. I sense just from looking at you, you find this incredibly rewarding, don't you?
Oh yeah, it's great. I mean, especially when people make that kind of transformation and really get involved in doing something because of the programming.
Yeah.
And the programming that I do can really be about anything. You know, some of it's about politics. It can be about history. We do a lot of Chicago history, of course. We do film and music. You know, last Friday I was out at our Chatham Cafe. We had Prexy Nesbitt out there. He was a Parker.
Sure.
Went to Francis Parker.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Nelson Mandela and the liberation movements in Africa.
Where's the place in Chatham?
It's on 83rd Street,
okay.
33 East 83rd. It's just east of the Dan Ryan at the 83rd Street.
Near State.
Yeah.
It sounds like Chuck Freilich is the Director of Repriorment and Lifelong Engagement at Mather Lifeways. He's going to be back after the news, and I'm going to play you an Alan Barkus song that is his most popular song. When he first gave me his CD about 10 years ago, I played – here's a good example of – who listens to the lovely people who listen to this show. I played this, his original tune, all of its original, and the title is It Ain't Easy Getting Old. So stay tuned. You will hear that after some commercials and then after the news. Stay tuned. We're talking about old mutual friends of ours. I'm with Chuck Freilich, who's the Director of Repriorment and Lifelong Engagement at Mather Lifeways. I'll tell you, last year, New City, a publication I respect and a publication I'm stunned is still printed. It's gone through it's an ink on paper publication. They also have a website. Every year they published a Best of Chicago issue. And last year, 2017, Best Cafe for Artistic, Open-Minded Seniors and Anyone Else Who Wants to Come, Mather's More Than a Cafe. And I know you're too self-effacing to take this, but it says in a series aimed at active seniors over 50, Chuck Freilich, formerly of Columbia College Fiction Department, books lectures and wide-ranging programs. Topics run from Gwendolyn Brooks, Tuskegee Airmen, Gypsies, Dick Biondi, Eartha Kitt, Carter Woodson, Judy Garland, Evel Knievel, John Dillinger, Leonardo da Vinci, the Cook County Forest Preserves, Kiss of the Spider Woman, to the Chicago Blues.
I don't recognize all those programs, but
yeah, I thought you booked them and some didn't show.
Right.
Now, do people come to you, Chuck, and solicit your attention to be booked into places, because there are people who do kinds of tours and stuff.
There's some people, right? There are a number of people who do regular programs for groups like the libraries or, you know, the museums and things like that. So there are people who do programs, and they do sometimes approach us, but most of the programming, you know, we do on our own. And I wanted to emphasize, as I mentioned to
others,
you, that I'm not the only one doing programming.
Well, this New City must have made you angry. Your colleagues must have gone, hey, man, what do you get?
What about us?
Yeah, because, what about us?
Because there are many people who contribute to the programming.
Well, what do you – is it – you trust your gut and something, you'll read a story about someone or you'll read a book review and you trust your gut, don't you, about what might work and what might
and
not work.
I mean, I'm sure you're the same way, and most people can tell. I mean, when I speak to somebody on the telephone, I can often tell whether they'll be a good presenter or not.
Sure.
Right. So I do that, and you get ideas really in the most random ways. It's funny. One came up the other day. So we were talking about how difficult it is to get an audience sometimes for our programs. You know, we think they're interesting. We try to get programs that we think our audience will like. We try to get suggestions from them.
For your kind of program, what time during the day do you mostly?
Well, most of the lifelong learning programs we do in the early afternoon, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock.
Yeah, sure.
Programs usually last about an hour. We do some programs also in the evening, musical performances we do in the evening. But we were talking about how difficult it is to get an audience. And I always bring up the example of Saul Bellow, who I saw a long time ago, you know, at Crocs and Brentano's on Wabash.
Yeah.
And he was signing books. And there was nobody there.
Nobody there.
So here, yeah, you know, you got me, a Nobel Prize winner for literature, and nobody is there to buy his book. And then I mentioned that another time I was at Crocs, I saw Lana Turner there, and there was a huge line out the door.
Well, of course,
to
there
see
would.
Lana Turner.
Well, she was a much better writer than Saul Bellow, for God's sake, Chuck Riley. Well, I'll never forget. I'll tell my one book story. I had done a book called Dr. Nightlife Chicago, which was a collection of nightclub columns in about 1978, and there was a book signing at Marshall Field and Company on whatever their book floor used to be. They don't have that anymore. I wind up sitting between Jim Davis, the cartoonist and author of the Garfield, the cat books, and Stephen King.
Whoa.
There are two endless lines going out. People would get bored, walk up to my empty line table, look at my book, and then go find their place in one of those lines. The nicest thing about it was Stephen King and Jim Garfield both bought a copy of Dr.
Oh,
Knight.
Right.
In Stephen King's library, I'm sure, is that. But and how do you occasionally have probably made a mistake, and you had your instincts were right, and you booked somebody who was just, you don't have to mention names, but who was just terrible, who couldn't speak in public.
Oh, you mean somebody who actually wasn't very good. Well, I'll tell you, just in general, I'll mention this, because you know I come from academia.
I do.
I mean, Columbia College, you know, which is a different kind of a place, or was, at least when I was there.
It changed a lot over the last.
Right, it's changed a lot. But anyway, I have had a lot of problems with academics because they don't often know how to speak to a general audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're full of technical jargon or, you know, and they're boring sometimes. And so so I usually try to warn people from academia in advance, you know, remember this is a general audience you're speaking to, you know, try to keep the jargon to a minimum. So maybe that, you know, that's one kind of general problem. But generally, I'd say we've had good luck with our speakers, and we've had some, you know, really good people. And
what's one or two that really, if not surprised you, because you do you know, solid research behind these, but but was there a couple that just blew you away?
Well, there were a lot, actually. I mean, I can mention a whole bunch
of
them. But, I mean, one that you would know about probably is Jim Jacobs, the author of Grease.
Oh, God, yeah, sure.
So Jim came out to the cafe, and he was just fabulous.
Now, how did you get Jim, who is...
Well, that was a search.
A
lot of times I do have to, you know, do a little detective work.
Sure.
And it was hard to find him, and I think... I don't remember exactly the path, but I think I went first maybe to Bill Williams at Columbia. And I spoke to him, and I think he suggested maybe getting in touch with Gary Houston.
Oh,
is that
God,
possible?
These are all my old friends.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I thought so. So, and you remember Polly Penn, of course.
Oh, very well.
Greece.
Very well.
So, I mean, I had some connections I was working on, and eventually I found him. I found an email address for him.
Sent
him.
He's in California. One.
And he was more than happy to come back, actually, because... you know, because he comes here a lot for the Cubs games.
Yeah.
You know, and he's in Chicago. And so he said, well, maybe sometime when I'm in Chicago, we'll book a date. And he knew the cafe anyway, because he knew what it was before it was a cafe. He remembered it, the restaurant that was there.
Oh, how great.
The Skylark or something,
you know,
like that.
Because Jim, the great thing about Jim, he doesn't have to get out of bed to make like $1 million a year.
Oh, I mean, yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah,
I mean, what a gold mine Greece has
that
been.
That started
for him.
in a storefront,
right,
you know,
we
real storefront.
Right.
Yeah, we were there.
We saw the beginnings of it. But
Polly Penn, it was the, you know, 16-year-old Latin school student when she was in that show.
Right.
Yeah, that's the greatest theatrical triumph in the history of Chicago.
The great thing about Jim, and the reason he was such a great guest, is because he was so enthusiastic about it, and you could tell that the money wasn't really what was driving him. You know, he really loved the music. That's why he wrote this, you know, this musical. And so that enthusiasm kind of just came out. Also, he was just very funny and a good speaker and just very down to earth and natural.
Yeah, you know? Should mention that he collaborated on that play with the late Warren Casey. And they were quite a pair. That was like, they just struck gold.
Yeah, I know.
And the show changed radically. It was a little rawer on Lincoln Avenue.
He revived it, and he tried to do recently.
Yeah,
he tried to do the show the way it was originally.
Right, the 40th anniversary. It's pushing 50 years. I mean, it really is pushing years. That's great. I'm glad
to hear that. The other thing is, you know, we try to make it a kind of memorable experience by adding things to the program. So, of course, you know, we added food from the 50s, you know, regular Coke and old Coke bottles. And we had the cafe decorated 50s style, you know. So we try to make it a real experience and not just, talking.
What size crowds do you get?
Well, the cafes are small. So
I remember that.
Now, when you came, we had a nice crowd for you. I don't remember.
I don't either.
It was one of the biggest, of course.
The biggest ever. It was the biggest
I'll tell you,
history,
the biggest ever, actually. But, you know, media people actually draw the most. People like Roy Leonard. Roy was great and came out, you know, shortly before he passed.
Yeah.
And another guy who's been there several times is John Drummond.
Oh, Bulldog.
Yeah, Bulldog.
Good old Bulldog.
He's been there, you know, at our cafe in Norwood Park, I think, about four times. And
that's
people
great.
Still love him, you know, because he's a great guy.
Well, we'll see what happens if you could ever get Tom Skilling to come to one of these things. We got to take a short break.
Somebody has mentioned that to me.
He'd have to rent the auditorium theater. we'll be back after a short commercial break and finish off with Chuck Fraile. You've been great. I mean, this is fascinating to me on many levels. And you will hear Alan Barkus's most famous song. We'll be right back. Talking about getting older and the pensions and retirement and all that stuff, because Chuck deals with a lot of people who are in that not unpleasant position as the director of Repriorment and Lifelong Engagement at Mather Lifeways. If you've been listening to him talk, you should go to Mather Lifeways, MATHERLIFEWAYS, not just to, you know, I'm not saying you're in ready to move in, but the More Than a Cafe that Chuck is involved in are wonderful places. I mean, they have great food and they have tons of programming, much of it with very interesting people like Rick Kogan, Chuck Osgood, Roy Leonard, but also covering a variety of different disciplines and different areas, some of it entertainment, some of it, a little more rarefied than that. And after each one of these, do people know that you're the person programming? So when you're there, do they come up to you and go, that guy was stupid. He's an idiot. I don't ever have him back here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I always get, you always get good feedback from the audience. Yeah, and they do talk to me. But they know that the cafe managers and other people are also doing the programming, so they speak to them as well. And usually the receptionists at the cafe get most of the feedback, and so they can tell, whether somebody did a good job
That's
or
right.
not.
Chuck, it seems, I'm so happy for you, because it seems like this is something that is really rewarding for you.
Well, it's fun. I mean, it is fun making all of these connections and learning about other people. I should say also we have other, programs that we do. We do programs over the phone. And we've had a lot of fun with some of those programs.
Like what?
So that's just like we've had a few celebrity guests on there, including some great people like Rose Marie.
Oh, my God.
We had her interviewed shortly before she passed.
Yeah.
It was probably one of the last interviews she did. And we do all kinds of regular programs on the telephone, like television, we do programs about television, programs about opera, programs about art history. And so to interview Rose Marie, I had our regular television guy, Wally Pedrazic, who teaches
Wally
at UIC.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So I asked Wally to interview her, and he did a great job with her. And The first celebrity guest we had on there was Tippi Hedren. I asked Roy Leonard to interview her. Roy had a lot of fun with that, I think, because he hadn't been doing that in a long time. So he really enjoyed that.
It sounds great. You're having fun. I want you to stay here while I play this Alan Barkus song. This is Alan Barkus, now the greatest. He cannot be an octogenarian yet, but the greatest septuagenarian basketball player in the world. So in honor of the great skill that Chuck Freilich and I used to have on the basketball court, along with Mike McCarthy and Tom Brown and the other legends of the Independent League, here is Alan Barkus's It Ain't Easy Getting Old.
Getting old, that's what the wise men say. Might as well wind it up. Looks like your time is up, and who knows if you'll even make it through today. It ain't easy getting old. Soon you're slow fade away. One time when you were hot, you said what happens when you're not, and now you got to answer every single day. You got early evening nightlife, you got chemically aided sex. You think you'll hit the bottom, then the legs go next. Ain't dead, but it's got the same effect. It ain't easy getting old. You've been rolling dice with fate, she's never lost a bet. You think about the money that you're never gonna get, and all of them fine young women, well, they haven't shown up yet. It ain't easy getting, in fact, it's damned upsetting. It ain't easy getting old.
That, the great Alan Barkus. If you were listening to Chuck Freilich, it is kind of easy getting old because there are places like Mather Lifeways that do all this programming and turn people on to new interests. Retired life is, as we sort of think of it, and we think of it mostly as in a cliched kind of way, it ain't that way anymore. I mean, we're talking about George Freeman. He's 91 years old. He's playing gigs all over town. So don't think of it that way. Go to MatherLifeways.com. And Chuck, it's great to see you.
It was great.
Chuck was
a
great basketball player. I was okay, but I was younger, so I didn't mature. I didn't mature till later. One day we'll have him come on here. We'll have a Latin school reunion on here. Talk about all the great things we've done. Aubrey Mumpower, thanks for engineering. Ben Anderson, thanks for producing. We got to get a little commercial break in here, and then I will say goodbye formally. Once again, Aubrey Mumpower, thanks for engineering. Ben Anderson, thanks for producing. Carl Amari is coming up. I will see you, or you can listen to me, next Sunday.